that's cool. I mean, we're already chatting, so everyone should know by now that this is the Aftershocks Ninja Podcast with Travis and Martin. Ronnie's not here. He's busy playing baseball again, I think.
So, is it baseball season again?
I don't know. That's what I look, dude. I assume baseball with Ronnie. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. No, he mentioned baseball. I thought you started in the spring.
Look, I don't know. Maybe he's going to see football games.
Yes, well, he is doing that, but probably not on a Monday night.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. My youngest daughter does cheerleading, and their games are on Monday nights.
Football games?
Yeah.
I don't know, man. I thought they were all Friday, Saturday nights for high school.
Well, high school. She's in fourth grade, third grade.
All right.
Look, I don't know how it is in California, okay? But in the South, football is very important, okay? Everybody plays football.
We like football over here too. I don't know your town, but we got a lot going on in my town. I know there are certain parts of the country where, like, you know, high school football is the show. Mm-hmm. In that town for half the year. So I get that.
Yeah.
You know how it is.
Yep. So Ronnie's busy. It doesn't matter. We're here. And we're not talking about this week's books. We're going to talk about last week's books because somebody fell asleep last week. We won't name who that person is. It might have been me. Who knows? Nobody knows.
Yeah, it's my fault for living on the West Coast, dude.
It's super all Travis's fault. That's right. It's Travis's fault.
Also on the intern, so, you know, it's probably automatically my fault.
So we'll be talking about last week's books. We've got Clan Killers number 3, Dark Arc 10, Pestilence Son of Satan 4, and Relay number 3. What do you want to kick off? Oh, before we continue, Ronnie and I will be recording another episode this week in which we'll talk about this week's books. So never fear, we're here for you.
It's a heavy week, dude.
Yeah, it's another heavy week. We have Moth and Whisper number 1, Hot Lunch Special 2, and Volition number 2. Good stuff.
Yeah. So, yeah, maybe 7 books worth of reviews in 1 week. That's good value.
That's great value. It's like, I don't know, extra fries at McDonald's. Do you pay for those?
Yes, exactly like that.
Are they free? If you get a large size, is it free or are you paying? Now, I'm pretty sure you pay for that, right? Look. You're paying an extra dollar for 2 episodes, and by an extra dollar, I mean nothing.
Yeah, so it's extra good value.
Extra good value. All right, let's talk about some books. Where do you want to kick off?
I don't know. You want to do Clan Killers first?
Man, you read my mind. Clan Killers number 3. This is written by Sean Lewis with art by Antonia Fusso, colors by Stefano Simeone, and letters by Dave Sharp. That Dave Sharp, man, I tell you. Prolific.
Yeah, I think he just got engaged too, right?
Oh, did he?
I saw a letter tweet, you know, over the weekend that they got engaged to somebody else in the industry, I think. It's one of the Daves, so.
Well, Dave, if it was you, happy engagement. Congratulations.
For sure.
That's exciting. All right, so let's talk about Clan Killers.
Yeah, man. Okay, so the thing that jumped out at me from this issue, and you know, it's kind of a minor point maybe, but I was very interested what happened to Patrick's wife, you know, Finola's mother.
Yes,
right, because in one of the scenes, they're kind of talking about the king said that Finola was responsible. And they don't really explain that any further. You know, there is the scene, I believe, in the beginning where basically you're flashing back to, like, the happy family scenes and you see Balor sneaking up from behind. So that would imply that, you know, like, what we already know, that at least from Finn's perspective, it was her that was driving that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of what I have mentioned previously, right? I think when we talked about issue 2, I talked about it. I may have brought it up when we talked about issue 1 as well. It seems to me like the fact that the king made a deal with Balor is what made him the complete and utter douchebag that he is. And that he was not always this way.
like it you know, emotionally or psychologically it affected him, or both. Like magically it changed him.
Well, maybe even magically. Yeah, so all of the above. Because, I mean, there's a few flashback scenes in here. He seems extremely happy. He's playing with all the kids. The kids look very happy, right? Whenever we see them, they're all smiling. Even at the beginning of the issue, there's the one image where the mom's not there. It's just the king and the kids and their dog. And even then, they seem pretty happy. It's just once we get a little bit later and we see that Balor's the one whispering things into his brain, that he seems to go a little nutso.
Yeah, I mean, there's still a lot of mystery about the deals that Patrick made kind of in his ascendancy,
mm-hmm.
you know, and like the things that he's on the hook for. I think we certainly have heard that he kind of promised things to like humans, you know, people from other clans and stuff who helped him to get his way.
Yep.
I think you could probably also assume that, you know, promises were made to Balor explicitly, which maybe is tied up into what's going on with her, you know? They don't seem to be good promises, you know, it all, like, seems like, you know, someday he's going to have to pay the bill and it's not going to be a good scene.
Well, it seems to me like he made a lot of promises to Balor and the Banshees in order to achieve the level of power that he has, but never followed through on those promises. And so he's using the other human clans to keep all the mystical stuff at bay, right? Because there's like a clan of vampires. There's that other clan that looked like, I don't know, ghosts maybe, like energy beings. They're all kind of kept out in the woods. The Banshees are not allowed near human settlements, right? They're also in the woods. So it seems like he's using his bartering power with the human clans, maybe like fear tactics, I would assume, right? Like, if you help me, then we can keep all these mystical beings at bay. But meanwhile, maybe the original plan was for him to sacrifice all the other clans to gain power. And that's why Balor is so eager to help Finn, right? Because Finn's bringing all these other clans to the Banshee.
Yeah. I'm curious, and, you know, what exactly is going on in that dynamic with Balor and the Banshee, and, like, more to the point, what the Banshees are looking for in all this, mm-hmm. because, you know, this all seems very much to be a mechanism for them to get rid of all the clans.
Right.
You know? So, you know, like, I'm sure we'll figure out at some point what happened to them. Like, I guess they're banished magically,
yep.
I think,
yep.
was the thrust of whatever these, you know, agreements were between Patrick and the, you know, Balor or the other clans. To your point, Patrick is also a clan killer that they made a big deal about.
Yes.
So, like, he's already, I think, you know, played a part in cleaning up a lot of the clans that were out there and or kind of replacing them with his own people to try to maintain power. I don't know. I'm not sure it's – we really know why Patrick was – driven to do all this stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, if he had a, you know, abstract goal besides just get all the power.
Yeah, you're right. That seems to be like the one missing piece here, right? Because I think this issue gave us a lot of backstory as to kind of what's going on with everybody, right? Like how everybody's related in their actions, but it still doesn't explain the motivation of the king to do what he does. Right. And I mean, you could say that right now he's using all these fear tactics to stay in power because he's losing control. But how did he get to that place? Right. Cause we see Balor whispering into him, but that's it. Like, why is she whispering? What did she say to him that made him the person that he is?
Well, you know, my read of his character so far, like, I feel like on its face, he is crazy. You know, he's kind of a King Lear type where he's lost his touch with reality. And so he just rages against that. Like, everyone is an enemy And you know, in you know, the beginning, like the first issue, I think Finn really kind of says explicitly that, you know, that's a result of Balor getting in his ear and perverting him or something, you know. So like, those two things would work together, I think, logically, but I'm curious if there isn't some other intrigue, you know, that you know, like, everything's not necessarily what it appears to be with respect to, like, Finn or with the King.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, maybe there's going to be a twist somewhere.
Yeah.
Because she also is, like, a psycho, you know? And, like, there was a scene in this issue where they kind of... The King, who, it like, has... Admittedly, like, he's not unbiased, but he kind of is like, at least I have my gods. You have nothing except, like, hate and revenge.
Yeah, but...
You know what I mean?
But isn't that kind of what's driven him also?
It is now, I guess, arguably.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, this issue was really interesting. I dug it quite a bit. I think in terms of the story, it was the most solid of the three, I think, because it was also the most straightforward, too.
Yeah, and a lot of the, you know, the previous issues, I would argue, you had to do a lot to set it up and give a lot of backstory. And, you know, we get a little bit of backstory here, but it's seems to be largely just straightforward, like the story progressing in a pretty linear way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got that, like, establishing stuff out of the way, although maybe we'll get some more flashbacks at key points in the next issues.
Sure. All right, let's rate this one up.
All right, let me just say before I rate it up that I was also interested just in the concept that, like, Finn is now injured and she's kind of off the table, but her friend is still, like, going forward with the mission.
Yeah.
So I'm very interested in what's driving him, especially, like, given the setbacks they've already had. So I like that part of it too. As for rating, I think I would go 4 out of 5.
I think I'm with you. I'm going to go 4 out of 5 too. I'm really enjoying it. Really, really enjoying it. All right. I'll pick the next book and let's see. Let's do Pestilence, A Story of Satan No. 4. This is written by Frank Thierry. We've got art by Oleg Okunev. We've got colors by Guy Major and letters by Marshall Dillon. So I guess in this one, the center point is getting some backstory on tying a few things from both Volume 1 and Volume 2 together. So for one, we learn the story of how Isabel survived the zombie attack that killed her in the first volume. And we see that she didn't survive, right? She actually became a zombie. And they actually, she doesn't look as bad as the other zombies because she was already infected. And so when they started to attack her, they're like, oh, she's infected already. We're going to leave her alone. And they did. And she was saved by Roderick after, you know, at the end of the first volume, we had Roderick going around Europe with the holy water, saving everybody. So she was saved by him and, goes to work for the Knights Templar. And we get some awesome stuff about the Knights Templar, whom I love. I love the Knights Templar story. It's one of my favorite mm-hmm. things. And I love seeing it included in the story. And related to the fact that the destruction of the Knights Templar ties into this the Black Death, the zombie apocalypse that we have in this book. Because in that era, and that would have been, I guess, 100 years or so, maybe a little more, before the events of this book, King Philip, who ordered the execution of the Knights Templar, was possessed by Satan.
Yes. And, you know, I enjoyed that part of it, definitely. You know, like, I would argue, I think that's kind of, like, seeing things from this historical lens is what separates and elevates this series from any other zombie story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's not just that they're wearing armor, but, like, they actually do some stuff that is connected to real history to, you know, like they use that as a trestle to like to build their story.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what makes it particularly interesting to me is the fact that, you know, this time frame in human history, we don't have like a lot of reliable written records, you know what I mean? So you can easily tell stories in this era and make them different. I mean, obviously, zombies don't exist, right? Or we assume, at least. I heard there was a zombie plane in New York last week. Did you hear about that?
No.
Yeah, apparently. I don't know. That was like the headline for the thing. Obviously, it's not zombies. You should look up the zombie plane in New York. But anyways, you know, zombies aren't real. But because we don't have a lot of reliable records from the era, you can tell these kind of stories where you can extrapolate and also kind of bring in elements of folklore from the era and make them appear real, right? Like King Arthur stories, for example, where they could be based on real people, but because you've had the story handed down over generations, the stories kind of change what the original story was. And then you can also bring in some, I guess, modern fears, you could say, to change the stories and make them interesting. And I think a lot of that is what makes this book really good. Because the way that it's told is told in a way where, I mean, I guess technically it could happen if you believe in zombies and the devil.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, like we're seeing it through the modern lens, you know, the scientific perspective. So, you know, I think most would agree that zombies and magic, there's no proof that actually exists.
Right.
But yeah, you know, like to your point, through the lens of history, it is interesting if you tell the story that it used to exist. You know, there was a time where it was real, but since, you know, records are shoddy at best, and it was a superstitious time, mm-hmm. you can write off anything that does exist or does not exist. But also, they do tie the zombie plague to the Black Death.
Yep.
And, you know, that's a pretty novel idea, you know, as far as being like, okay, well, actually, there is tons of evidence about it. They just didn't say what it was or whatever, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So that's cool.
Yep, I agree. Question for you. Do you think this, the second Fiat Lux, do you think they know that the Pope is the devil?
Good question. I would say not necessarily, right? Because they've just gotten their instructions via letter.
Right.
I as far as we've seen. So that is an interesting thought. You know, I hadn't thought of that, because obviously when they deliver it, they might be able to figure out that something's amiss, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, and the thing is, you know, the Fiat Lux are supposed to be kind of honorable warriors, right? And obviously they're the warrior arm of the church. And so, yeah, if they just get their instructions by letter, they're not going to know anything, right? They're just like, okay, the church wants this. That's what we're going to do. They just kind of appear like bad guys here because they're after revenge for their dead brother. But I wonder if they knew what really is going on at the Vatican, if they would follow through with this.
My read on them was, you know, beyond just the revenge thing, which is obvious, you know, I kind of got the idea maybe that they were, you know, potentially corrupt or, you know, like at least kind of interested in, you know, the money of it or, you know, like the power. But it is interesting, the, you know, the idea that maybe if they were to figure it out that they might flip sides. And, you know, we started the series out with a glimpse of, you know, a hooded figure and he's about to try to kill the Pope. And
yep.
The question is, who is it?
Yeah. Right.
So that would be a pretty big twist if it was one of them.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. To the point about the, Domenico brothers, you know, what I thought was interesting in this issue is, you know, they kind of do this thing And they, you know, attack Roderick and his people or whatever, and they make off with his son, right?
Mm-hmm.
So his son was the object of that mission.
Right.
Even so much so that killing Roderick and the rest of them seems to be secondary.
Yes.
So what's the plan for the son, especially if they could have just killed Roderick?
That is a great question, and I have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, there must be something, right? But that really stuck out to me, you know, is like, that's significant.
I mean, maybe there's something special about him. I mean, we haven't seen any of that, right? So we can't really say that he is. You know, it'd be cool though, is if Roderick's son ends up being the boy king from Black Eyed Kids. That'd be awesome.
That would be awesome, dude. Trying to build that shared universe ever so slowly.
Yep. Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, my assumption is really just that they, you know, he just wants to make Roderick work for it, right? Mm-hmm. He wants to get revenge on Roderick. And there's not like a specific plan. It's just like the best way to get back at him. And you see this kind of thing all the time in like movies, right? If you want to get revenge on somebody, you don't go after them. You go after their family. Because then you leave them alive to kind of deal with the death of the people they love the most.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it implies that, you know, the devil has, like, a personal grudge towards Roderick.
Mm-hmm.
Which it just seems like if the whole world is going to die, why waste your time, you know? Like I don't discount, you know, sadism and you know, just general insanity as kind of explanations for why people make intricate tricks for, you know, heroes. But, you know, it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. Anything else you want to discuss about this one?
Okay, yes. Just kind of the other thing that jumped out at me. First off, do you remember how they come to know that the Pope is, like, not only the head zombie, but just a zombie?
No. Isn't it through, right? Like, isn't it through Isabel?
I mean, it could be. I was trying to flip through, like, the last issue, and I didn't necessarily see it. I'll allow that I guess they can figure it out somehow. Or they just infer it from the way that stuff is going down, like he raided the Westminster Abbey or whatever.
No, you know what? You know what? I remember now. They had one of their guys was taken over in the first volume. I think the one that was the friar, the bald one, he was taken over and turned to a zombie and then brought back to being a human. And I think there was, like, they were in a camp or something, and he showed up, and they're trying to get information from him, like, where he's been, this, that, and the other. And he starts telling him everything about the Pope, and then towards the end of the story, he gets possessed by Satan and attacks him.
Okay.
And I don't know if it was the last issue or the second issue. It might have been issue two.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm just – I was curious about that, but I was also curious in a larger sense of – you know, they're basing their theory of this is what we're going to do,
mm-hmm.
You know, on, you know, a thing from a century previous where they have, like, that's their frame of reference. They're like, well, what it is the devil, you know, infected, you know, this body and, you know, he was the leader or whatever, and you kill him and the rest of it goes away.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I was interested in that, but it seems to me like the leader himself, if it's a devil or whatever, has made comments in this series that whatever is happening now is different from what happened before.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm just kind of, I guess, unclear about the progression of conclusions that get them to why, because the devil seems to jump in and out of anybody he wants, you sure. know, when he talks to them or whatever. So it's interesting that they get to the conclusion that if they kill the Pope, that's going to fix it all.
Well, I think the reason for that is, I think the devil is actually inhabiting the Pope. right?
Yeah, like it from issue two.
Yeah, yeah, the butt sex scene.
Yeah,
he's actually inhabiting him. When we see him inhabiting other bodies, I don't think he's actually there, right? It's just like a astral projection into those bodies that he can control because they've previously been infected by the zombie plague, and that's what allows him to channel himself into those bodies. But I don't think he's actually inhabiting those bodies when we see him.
Yeah. Okay, that's fair. I just think it's interesting that you would do something that makes you vulnerable like that.
Yeah.
You know, when he was clearly doing a lot of stuff before he jumped into the Pope's body. Mm-hmm. But I'll allow that, you know, we still don't know a lot of stuff, so.
Yep. Cool. Ratings.
You first.
All right. 4 out of 5 for me again. I think I rate like every one of these issues 4 out of 5. Sometimes 5 out of 5.
No, not all the time.
Pestilence.
Oh, Pestilence. Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, fair enough. I think I'll go 4 out of 5 too.
Great. What do we have? Is this one more issue, right?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so. Cool. That should be a good one. Maybe we'll see some more, insane nipple shots. That could be the episode title. Yeah, let's hope so. All right, I'll let you pick the next one. We got Dark Arc 10 and Relay 3.
Let's go Dark Arc. I think Relay is a good finisher.
Man, we're on the same page because I assumed that was going to be your choice. Dark Arc number 10 is written by Cullen Bunn with art by Wando, letters by Ryan Hill, and Wando does this on coloring, so there's no colorist. All right, let's talk about this one.
Sure thing, man. This is really the culmination of the second arc, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think you could argue the whole thing built towards, oh, you know, here's this crazy new threat out of left field, you know, Echidna, mother of all monsters. And, you know, this issue kind of, we see that effectively, you know, put to bed. And, in the final page, you know, they reveal that the rain has stopped. So I think that points to where the story is going, you know, like sooner rather than later, they're actually going to be heading back towards lands, yes. Dry lands.
Yes. And I think based on the cover for the next issue, maybe actually meet the people of Noah's Ark.
Hmm. Think they'll, you know, probably, how could they avoid talking about what was on their ark? Hey, nice arc. What you like? You got animals too? Nope.
Yeah.
Just a big empty arc. No yeah. monsters. Just a big, that's what you're asking.
There's no monsters or anything in here. That's ridiculous. What monsters? Get out of here. It's
making like some scary sounds though. So
being in that flooded water must have messed with your mind. There's no such thing as monsters. What? Oh, that giant thing floating over there, bleeding to death? No, that's not a monster either.
Dude, Noah's Ark is like totally oblivious. They must be real far away.
Well, wait. We assume that they're oblivious. But remember, Noah was sacrificing animals to the Echidna.
Mm. Okay. So, maybe.
So they may not be totally oblivious.
Yeah, he might be oblivious to the other Ark unless Echidna, you know, talks.
Sure. Sure. And that's possible because Echidna, I think, knew about both arcs, right? I'm really surprised that we haven't had, like, even just one full issue taking place in Noah's Ark. And I'm curious to know why that is, right? I mean, I understand that probably everybody knows the story of Noah's Ark, or at least the majority of people are at least vaguely familiar with the story of Noah's Ark. So, you know, that's one possibility of why we haven't seen it. But I'm curious in terms of the story, why it hasn't been a larger part of it, right? I mean, even with the flashback scenes, all the flashback scenes take place at Trey's Ark with people lined up, you know, all the way back to try to help them.
Yeah, I mean, I think it could be explained away as easily as it's not their perspective, you know, like. Like most of the stuff that we've seen arguably is from the perspective of Shrey and his arc. So, you know, like narratively, you know, there, it's not assumed that you just jump to another perspective, you know, like some people might, but it's not required. And, you know, there is a possibility that, again, there's, you know, more than meets the eye, that, you know, like I think you and Ronnie alluded to, you know, intrigue about, you know, like we really don't know, you know, who gave Noah his orders, who gave Shrey their orders, yep. You know, like, so, I mean, there's a lot of assumptions, you know, so there's always a possibility that it's been, you know, kept obscure for a reason.
But see, that's why I want to see it, right? I understand that the book is called Dark Ark, not Noah's Ark, and I understand that we have a different cast of characters, but I think the story is in a place right now where it would be really interesting to see the other side of the story, right? And I'm not even talking about doing a full arc, like just one issue. I would love to know, like, the reaction of Noah to Shrey building his ark, whether he even knew that that was being done. Cause like, you know, in the Bible story, there's no mention of any of that, right? So maybe we can assume that Noah was totally oblivious to another ark being built. And yeah, I want to know, like, who gave Noah his orders, because we kind of know who gave Shrey his orders. But like you said, we've kind of debated whether that's true or not, or whether there's not something else going on. I don't know. I think there's a lot in there. But let's go back to this issue. The little underwater creature things.
The sea zombies.
The sea zombies. Those are just people that died during the flood.
Seemingly.
My question is, how do they turn into zombies?
Yeah, I couldn't tell you, man. I mean, is it possible it's specific to whatever that city was and not necessarily, you know, like all humans on Earth turned into zombies that are apparently like super short lived, you know, cause Shrey himself says like these zombies ain't gonna make it, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know why they could survive underwater for, you know, question mark amount of time without food and get a big meal and then die right when it's starting to dry out. Maybe there's zombies under the ocean all the time.
It's possible.
We don't go under, you know, there's a lot of the ocean we haven't explored. So there's like zombie regions of the oceans, maybe.
I love it.
I'm going to say.
Now I want to go in the ocean and look for zombies.
Yeah, dude. Hit up James Cameron.
I thought that was interesting. And yeah, I don't know if there's something special about this one city, or it's just the fact that this is just the place that we're at now, and this is happening in all the cities. But one thing I thought would have been cool, and I try to reread some of the stuff to see if there's been a reference to it, but it would have been cool if the city that these zombies are coming from was Atlantis, right? Because that would bring in another, like, mythological thing from the past. And kind of could tie it in to the story pretty interestingly. Cause you know, there's stories of Atlantis where like they kind of become like fish people, right? When the city gets, sent underwater. And I thought that would have been cool if there were like fish people zombies, you know? I don't know. Just a little thing.
Dude, that'd be amazing, man.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
Don't steal it.
Yeah. Well, I won't, yeah. But I mean, yeah, like, I don't know. It's just weird that they chose to introduce that and then immediately be like, but don't worry about that because, you know, it's not going to come back, you know?
Yeah.
It's one and done, you know? Like, Echidna's poison, so they're all dead anyway, but...
Well, but this also has to show the malice of Shrey, right? Because they're not trying to kill him. They want Shrey to help them. And Shrey's like, yeah, no problem. I'll help you. You can come hang out on the Ark, and we'll take you to dry land. But we need you to attack Echidna because she's trying to destroy the Ark. And so that's what happens. Echidna's trying to destroy the Ark and get all the monsters on her side. And all the fish people zombies come up and eat her to death. But then he keeps sailing the ship because he's like, screw you guys. I'm out of here.
Yeah, dude. No, I was going to say, like, you know, I think that's interesting. He, you know, he betrays the sea zombies in this issue, right?
Yep.
You know, he makes a deal and he's like, you do this thing for me and we'll be good. You know, I'll, like, you can come on the arc or whatever you want. And he's like, I'm not going to do that. You know, so he betrayed them. Mm-hmm. He also betrayed the people that built his arc.
Yep.
Arguably, yep. You know, I think that they're building a pattern of a guy that, you know, does what he needs to do, you know, he's an interesting character and I'm interested what motivates him, you know, can anybody trust him, including whoever gave him the job to, you know, ferry the monsters to the new world.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like there's nobody that he won't betray except maybe his family, who could be the rationale for him doing all of this.
Well, I think you bring up an interesting point, though. Obviously, he's doing a lot of very shady things, but does that necessarily make him a bad person? Because, I mean, ultimately, he's saving his family, right? And he's doing whatever he has to save them. Sure, like, you know, he's dicking over the monsters and the fish people and this, that, and the other. But he definitely has a strong moral compass, I would say. He's just able to do whatever he has to accomplish his goals. And, you know, maybe that makes him a strong person and not necessarily a bad guy. You know, maybe Noah is kind of the bad guy because he doesn't have the balls to face Echidna and find a different solution other than feeding her giraffes or whatever else. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, to that point, maybe if Noah had actually heard from the angels who visited Shrey by mistake, they would have taken care of the Echidna thing themselves.
Quite possible.
Yeah. But, I mean, yeah, to your point, I think it's also an ethical question of, is it wrong to do a bad thing to a bad person / monster,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like obviously the sea zombies are arguably not humans, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any answering that part of it. But, you know, as far as the bad person thing, the people that built his arc, et cetera, that's interesting, you know, because he was kind of discerning about, you know, there's the scene where he turns away the. He's trying to turn away the mother, and the mother, like, gives up her kid, and she's like, okay, cool, you know, like, you can get on the ark now.
Mm-hmm.
So that suggests that there was some kind of, you know, moral calculus towards who's going to become monster food.
Sure.
He's an interesting, you know, complicated character.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, final words on this one, Dark Ark number 10. I have one final word. I'm still very confused as to why Kroll is so obsessed with that dang girl.
I just think it's a kindness, you know? Like, I thought that was a nice part of this issue, was his interest the whole time was, like, just leave this girl alone, you know?
Well, no, it's leave her alone because Shrey promised her to me.
No, but, I mean, like, when they're like, okay, she's yours, and he says, like, okay, well, she's free, she's with... She was phrase people.
I see what you mean. Yeah.
Know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I don't know what... I'm trying to think back to what their specific interactions were previous to this, you know? And, you know, if there's something specific that this is kind of in recognition of, or if he just likes her, and so he's like, I'm going to make this a thing that I do.
Sure.
Clearly, you know, they set up some kind of connection between them basically from the beginning, so.
All right, fair enough. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, I'm good.
Cool, rate it up for me.
All right, I'm going to rock the boat and go 4 out of 5.
I am rocking nothing. I'm going to stick with my rating of 4 out of 5. All right, let's go to our final book of tonight, and that is Relay number 3. This is written by Zach Thompson with art by Andy Clark, colors by Jose Villarubia, and letters by Charles Pritchett. All right, so I guess this this is an interesting issue, I think, compared to the other two. One thing that I'm finding interesting about this book is that, while there's connections between each issue, right, because it's one cohesive story, I find the way that each one starts is pretty interesting, because it doesn't immediately follow the events of the previous book. And by that I mean like immediate follow, right? So like when they took Jad and they were taken back to the ship or whatever, like the next thing that you see isn't like them interrogating him. You get like this whole narration of Jad, about Donaldson's world and whether he has failed or not. He's still trying to find clues as to what's real and what isn't. It looks like he's not even imprisoned. He may still be in his apartment. I thought that whole thing was pretty interesting. But things do kick up quite a bit here, right? Because I can't remember, what's the girl cop's name that was with him in Donaldson's world?
I got a note that says Vic.
Okay,
Vic. Does that sound right?
Maybe.
Yeah.
We'll go with that. So Vic is interesting, right? Because it seemed like Vic doesn't entirely believe in the monolith. At least that's the impression that I got in the last issue. But she's very much about doing her job. And that changes quite a bit in this issue because it seems like she's all about the monolith and she's kind of like been infected by the monolith in some way, right? Cause she, when she arrests Jad in his apartment, for breaking whatever law number it was, she takes him and not to prison, she takes him to the monolith. And so he wakes up, he's like, where the hell am I? And she's like, you're in the monolith. Like, you're finally seeing the inside of it. And the explanation of how they got in there to me seemed a little weird. Because I thought from the information that we had before that even she wouldn't be allowed into the monolith, right? Like, there's only like a council of people allowed in there. But it seems like maybe that's not the case from what we saw in this issue.
Well, I think I'm going to have to start cracking into a bit of crazy theory time.
Yes.
If you don't mind.
Oh, no, I don't mind.
Okay. So, yes, I do agree that she really seems to have a huge departure for her character in this issue versus what we saw before. Even to your point, given her in the last issue being like, we know we have to do, you know, the rules are clear. We're just going to do what we always do in this situation and, you know, blow up this planet, you know, like my read on that isn't necessarily, I think you could just say, no, this is what the rules say. So, there isn't a debate. Mm-hmm. We're going to do this, mm-hmm. Versus in this issue. Yeah. She's very much like, I am, you know, killing this guy now for doing this thing that I've known him to do for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Burns took back souvenirs from the non-compliant planets constantly and said that to her.
Yes.
So she's acting out of character. Meanwhile, her face is falling apart.
Hmm.
You know, I don't know if you noticed that, dude. Like when she is trying to arrest Burns or whatever, or I guess it's Jad, part of her like jawline starts drooping down, like hanging off her, like silly putty. And in the next scene, she's got it all bandaged up. It comes off again. So juxtapose that with what we know the technology to already be, where they can synthesize whole planets and everything on them, maybe people, from some kind of like goop, you know?
Yep.
Like a generic material, like a stem cell for all material that they're just going to build anything out of.
Yep.
Meanwhile, we're in the monolith and they're talking about, we can make anything out of this material. And he's walking around and like sees a whole whatever room, empty wall full of like creepy blank fetuses or something.
Yep.
Do you remember that
part? I do. They show up in a few places, actually.
So I'm thinking that, yeah. Okay, so I'm thinking she's like a grown-up version of that. Like, they grow people that maybe work for the monolith, but maybe they don't even know. And she's, like, been a sleeper agent her whole life who is a skeptic, but a switch flipped, and now she has to do the monolith's bidding. And they're saying, she's like, the monolith speaks to me directly now, you know? So I think that it's just her programming kicking in that she has to serve the will of the monolith.
Mm. So I like this crazy theory. In fact, I agree with your crazy theory. I think when I saw the little droop thing on her face, I was like, wait a second. Something's a little off here. And then we do get that, like, cool Escher-looking page, right? Where, it was Escher, right? Yeah, it was Escher. Where Jad is, like, going, I mean, it doesn't follow the laws of physics, right? Like, he can walk upside down and, like, up and down. And, like, everything leads to one place. There's a lot of, like, droopy stuff, right? You see, like, Donaldson heads in a couple places. And there's, like, goop coming out of it. There's technology emerging from it. Like, there's even this, like, weird-looking cube thing that pops out of one of them. So, yeah, I agree. Now, to expand that, what if it's not just her that is now made up of goop, right? Like, maybe after the mission in the second issue, she was taken to the monolith to be reprimanded, right? Because she was in charge of the mission. And her punishment was to kind of be reconstituted in this goop thing, right? It's not just like she's always been a goop thing, is she's been replaced by a goop thing. So that's
number one. Yeah, it's like body snatchers.
Yeah, like body snatchers. So that's number one. Number two, what if everybody is made up of goop thing?
Ooh.
Okay. What if that is the actual mission of the monolith? Okay. So have you seen Prometheus?
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, in Prometheus, the ancients kind of create this goop, that is kind of alive. And that's kind of what turns into the aliens from the Aliens franchise. Because it can kind of like recombine its own genetics with whatever being it absorbs. And so that's why the aliens do look that particular way. There's been like other creatures that kind of get it, where they evolved the DNA of the, what are they called, the xenomorphs. They kind of evolved the DNA of the xenomorphs to have different characteristics, right? Which made for great toys, by the way, in the 90s, because I had all of them.
Yeah, dude. But Aliens 3?
Yeah, absolutely, right? Like the aliens that can swim, like all this other stuff. So what if it's like that? What if this goop is like the goop from Prometheus? And as they go into different worlds, the choice is still the same, right? Like, join us or die. The worlds that don't want to join, they get killed, completely obliterated. The ones that do want to join don't actually join the way that they think they would. They don't become part of a monoculture where they can share technology and knowledge. They get absorbed by this goop, just like what we saw in Donaldson's planet.
So, like, everybody is already a goop monster?
So anybody that's part of this monoculture is already a goop monster.
Yeah, I mean, I that's a crazy theory. So I tip my crazy theory hat. The only thing I would say, I guess, is, like, if that's already happened, then why go through the charade of giving them all free will when...
Have you never seen The Matrix?
Well, I do think that there could be some Matrix type, you know, philosophy there, like Matrix sequels being the caveat, you know,
yeah.
Like the kind of thing where you have to choose to participate or not. And the idea that maybe, you know, you maybe the system creates its own resistance as part of the equilibrium, you know? That's something that occurs to me when you have the means to create a whole planet full of goop people, you know, like Donaldson's planet that seemed to be wholly artificial.
Sure.
You know, whatever the anti-relay alliance is, which I was pretty excited to see that in the issue. I'm going to say they probably don't have the resources to make a whole decoy planet. That's pretty good for the resistance.
Why wouldn't they?
A whole planet?
Yeah, but it's irrelevant because, I mean, the goop, it grows itself.
Does it?
I mean, it seems like it does.
I mean, but you still would need some kind of input of resources or energy. I don't know if solar energy or whatever could get you to the point where it's like efficient for you to just create a planet with all kinds of stuff.
Well, I mean, it wouldn't be created overnight.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I'm sure it wouldn't take that long, right? Well, I mean, we don't know how this goop thing works, right? So if it's some kind of like self-replicating thing, then, you know, maybe in a few decades you could create a whole planet.
Okay, fair enough. I guess I just, like to the earlier point about the Matrix, analogy, like, I just wonder if somehow what we're seeing could be an exercise in that. Like, you make a planet that creates dissent that, like, maybe use that to root out the, unbelievers, you know, and clean house a little bit. That is analogous to the Matrix, where you create a system that involves periodic growth of dissenters and like a Neo that screws stuff up and ultimately fails.
Well, it doesn't fail. It's required, right? That's the reason why they, in the Matrix, why they chose the late 20th century, why they allowed human beings to continue having free will. Because then it allowed them to live a much more miserable existence, and people are miserable. And so when the monolith takes over a new planet, you want to still allow the people or aliens, whatever, the beings in that planet to continue feeling like they are in charge of their own lives, just living under the power and support of the monolith, right? Because if they feel like they have no choice, then ultimately that's when you start having problems, like real dissension.
Yeah. I can see that. God, what was I going to say? I guess the only question there though is, if you're going to take that approach, why go the Death Star route when anybody turns you down? You know, it seems like you could as easily just not give them a choice, ostensibly say like, hey, hi, you know, meet the new boss. We're here to conquer you. And we've already done it. So, you know, you could still have the same kind of mechanisms in place for the resistance or whatever.
No, but that's exactly my point though. If they are not willing to join this system, then it's going to be harder for them to be assumed into the system, right? By giving people the choice and allowing those that choose to join the system to join the system, then it makes it much easier to assimilate them into the Matrix.
Yeah, I'll buy that.
All right, Zach, I solved your puzzle, buddy.
Yeah, he was sweating it, dude.
Oh, man. No, I actually just came up with that today, because I was watching a video about simulation theory. You know about simulation theory, right?
No, I don't think so.
The theory that we don't live in the physical world, we live in a computer simulation.
Okay.
And so the video that I watched was simulation theory, with regards to Philip K. Dick. And so because Zach loves Philip K. Dick, I started thinking about this book today and how some of those things could apply to the story that he's trying to tell. So, I mean, I could be totally off, but you know, we love crazy theories anyway, so who cares? It's entertaining.
Everybody loves crazy theories, dude.
It's true.
you shoot at the moon and then, like, you know, one in a million, you're actually right. And you're like, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you ruined it for everybody.
Oh, man.
The line between spoiler and prescient theory is tenuous.
It is tenuous. It's very tenuous. Let's do final thoughts on relay number three.
I guess my final thought would be I don't know if it's even worth saying that, this like mystery coffee cup that we've seen says like a word that looks to be Zalis.
Yes,
I think.
Which was Donaldson's planet.
Okay. Because it also, I noticed that it was on, Jad's like conspiracy board.
Yep.
His thread board.
Yep.
Okay, so I didn't realize that was the name of the planet. The other final thought would just be that, again, this is a book that is so jam-packed on every page, it's impressive. It's difficult to dissect, every single issue is like a whole miniseries, So, I think that speaks to the strength of this title.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I every once in a while I like to read reviews for books that I really enjoy. And I read a review for this book and I was like, are we reading the same book? Cause I think oftentimes, first of all, let me say this. I have a problem with a lot of comic book reviewers. Because I feel like a lot of comic book reviewers don't know what the hell they're talking about. Because they don't have a large enough repertoire in their literary background. Both, like actual literature, like novels, and comic book as literature. And so oftentimes I see a lot of reviewers that make the mistake of reading the stories that they're reading at face value. And while that may often work when you're reading a Marvel or a DC book, it does not work as often when you're reading an indie book. And in particular, when you're reading an indie book from a writer whom I know is extremely smart and very well read, and really loves the stuff that he loves, you have to find a way to find what the alternate meanings are. And it might not always work that way, but at least for the stuff that I'm reading from Zach and Lonnie, it does work that way, right? When I talked to Lonnie and Zach on my other podcast, we talked about her Infernal Descent without me having read much of anything about that book, because I don't think it was even out when we talked. We had like an hour conversation just on the meaning of that book, right? And whenever we get together and talk about her Infernal Descent, we end up talking about it usually the most out of any other book. Relay's the same way. And we don't do a Vault Comics podcast, but Coming to Me is the same way as well. So you're right. Like, this book does have a lot in there, and it can definitely read as a fun sci-fi story. But if that's how you're reading it, then you're kind of missing a large chunk of the point of what this book is about.
Yeah, damn, dude. Like, I don't know. It seems pretty deep to me.
Yeah. Well, not everyone's as smart as you, Travis.
Oh, most people are smarter than me, but thank you.
Oh, man. All right, that's going to wrap up this episode, I think. Yeah, you good? Oh, we should rate it. We got to rate it. All right, I'll go with a 5 out of 5.
Me too. 5 out of 5.
Boom! All right, so Ronnie and I will be back in a couple of days. We'll be talking about Moth and Whisper number 1, Hot Lunch Special number 2, and Volition number 2. Of course, you can find us all on the social medias. The pipes. The pipes are getting full, Travis. Be careful. Travis is at The Great Magnet. Ronnie is at Rumba316. I'm at Geekvine. The show is at Aftershock Pod. And we'll catch you in a few.
Shock the world.